communicator Stephen Ward.
This sound was recorded on November the 6th, 1965, medium resistance.
Nice to know that you do, because from what I can make out of it, it's very difficult sometimes for people to be able to put over their personality, you know, and their sort of voice.
Mm.
Actually, I don't really know that I do so well, but you tell me I do.
No,
I often feel that I ought to do so much better.
Mm.
Very difficult to know exactly what one sounds like. I don't think that one can. I think it is that one concentrates oneself, is the only way I can put it. One's sort of whole being. I think the more you can sort of concentrate yourself as a person, you know, sort of forget all outside influences.
Yes.
In other words, exert yourself to such an extent that you presumably get over more or less something of yourself as you were. Though again, I suppose it rather depends on the individual as to how well they can sort of recapture themselves in memory. I sort of find that times, particularly now, I suppose, since I've been here a fairly long time and I've made some sort of progress in a different life, it's not altogether easy to sort of fall back on the old self. It's almost as if you're dual personality, as if you're something that you've become now, and at the same time you're sort of something that you once were. It's a sort of mingling of two selves. The old and the new.
Yes, it isn't a very easy thing to do, is it?
I don't
Although it may be easier when you get into the earthly vibration.
Well, I suppose in a kind of way, it's like a person when they're, say, 70, and they sit down and reflect on the past, and they try to recapture the memory of themselves when they were 20, what they looked like, what their thoughts and ideas were, and their personality generally. You look back and you see yourself as almost a completely different person, but of course in a sense you are. You're not the same now as you were, say, 30 years ago. You've matured, you've changed in so many different ways. It's as if you're an old self that is hardly recognizable. You know, it's sort of like going back. You have to concentrate, like Billy-O, to think about certain sort of periods of time in which you once had your life, you know, and the people that you knew and the sort of things that you said and the sort of interests that you had, you sort of think, oh dear, was that really me? Was I so sort of stupid, or was I so brash and so on, you know?
Mm.
Anyway, it's very odd. I mean, all I know is that I come here and I feel quite at home here. I always have, more or less. I mean, I felt a little bit odd in the first instance of trying to communicate because the whole thing was new and strange, but I never felt as if I were in a sense a stranger, which in a sense of course I was. I mean, I just felt that this was in a sense home.
Yes.
Very odd thing, because I'd never been inside the place before and I never really met you. I'd been here a few odd times with one or two other people, like Dr. Marshall, sort of on probation, I suppose, you know.
Yes.
And I sort of was shown the ropes and given a few tips as what to do and what not to do, and sort of stand there, good little boy, and watch, you know, and take it all in, you know. And eventually, if you're good, we'll let you have a go yourself. But, you know, I never felt sort of as if I were out of it. I always felt as if I were somehow part of it, you know.
Yes.
And actually, believe me, my God, you've got an entourage. You've simply got no idea.
Really?
Talk about a queen. My God, you really have, you know, a real entourage that masses itself around you. Talk about the Queen of Sheba going to visit Solomon.
What is that, Steve?
Oh, I suppose you've lived long enough to collect a hell of a lot of people. I suppose being interested so long in this subject,
yes,
and taking such a vast, you know, sort of keen interest, and having so many seances, I suppose you sort of added and added and added until now you have an entourage. It's like,
well, the medium must have it.
Oh, him. he's got an entourage all right, but they're mostly other people's.
What?
Mostly other people. You know, I suppose it's being a medium, you see.
Yeah.
All sorts of odd bobs, you know, relations of people that have sat with him over the years. Every now and again they pop back and think, oh, there may be an opportunity to get a word in, you know. And I suppose the medium collects more, in a sense, because people on this side know that he's a sort of avenue by which they can reach people on Earth.
Yeah.
So, actually, though, again, I wouldn't want to be a medium, because you see, the different peoples that attach themselves, good, bad, and indifferent, it must be a deuce of a job. You know, I mean, all sorts of influences at work.
Yes.
I should think they've got to be pretty stable. I think a medium not only must be highly sensitive, of course, to be a medium, but my God, they must have a will of iron if they're going to sort of get through life at all.
Yeah, I know, he's
very,
very moody, too, you know.
Well, I suppose in a sense that's understandable, because yes, there's so many influences brought to bear.
Yes.
I mean, by people on your side and people on this. Actually, I should imagine medium, being a medium is the most uncomfortable business.
Yes.
Actually, I know this sounds crazy,
yes,
but have you by any chance been thinking today in particular about a swan?
Swan?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it's the most extraordinary thing.
What?
Because in between the medium and yourself, someone, I know this sounds crazy, but I can't help it, has put the most beautiful swan.
Oh.
And I wondered if there's some special reason, because
I have been picturing swans in my mind.
Well, that must be what it is, because you see, I think your love of swans,
yes,
and the fact that you've been probably thinking today about a swan,
yes,
and
yes,
brought into being a sort of etheric, I suppose you call it, figure of a swan. It's most extraordinary. I mean, I don't normally sort of see this sort of thing. When I say I don't see things, when I see things here, to me, they're reality.
Yes.
But this, I can tell, is a sort of an etheric swan built up by a sort of conscious or subconscious thought. It has no sort of real being as such, but it's something obviously that's very near and dear to you, and you must have been thinking, because by your thought process you have created this, even though it's only temporary.
Oh, I tell you how it happened, Stephen. I got a packet from some investors, and there's a picture of a swan in it, and I've been looking at it, and in my imagination I was thinking of swans.
Well, it just goes to show, it's an illustration to me, just as it probably is to you, because I know that as I am here in this room, I can see this swan that is sort of conjured up, but it's very, very beautiful, and it's very real, inasmuch that it's something that is not exactly a reality on our side of life, but it's a very real thing by the power of love that's put into it. You must have a great sort of fondness for swans, because you see, people on your side, as a matter of fact, it was a thing that puzzled me at first, when I first sort of started coming back and knowing something about communication. I would sometimes see things, and I knew that although it was in a sense, to all appearances, a reality, I knew there was something about it that wasn't real. And I had to learn to distinguish between the reality of things and the creation of thought forces, building up images. You see, all around the earth there are these images and these sort of mental pictures that people do create when they are thinking very hard or when they're tremendously interested in something in particular. That is, even though it's only temporary in some instances, for instance, with a person who might be thinking very hard about a certain something or other and conjuring it up and creating it. It's like a sort of dream state. It's something which is very, in its own fashion, while it lasts, very real, and yet there is a subtle difference. I mean, for instance, now I can distinguish very easily between the realities of things and these things which are brought into being by a subconscious mind, and I think that's what happens, quite frankly, at a lot of seances. With certain types of people who are not really mediums and who probably create imagery within themselves, and they sort of create even false fictitious characters. I didn't realize this at first. Marshall put me onto this in the early stages, being able to sort of pick out the realities from these other things which have no real substance, although they may appear to have shape if it's only temporary. And I've come to a conclusion from what Marshall's told me, and for experience I made a point of finding out, with some of these ghosts that people see, which appear to be quite real. In other words, people on your side see an image, or they see a figure, and they see it as a ghost, but it has no substance, it has no reality. It's something that has been created in the atmosphere by strong thought forces over perhaps even centuries of time, and it has no reality as a person. In other words, the individual is not present, and that is, the ghostly form is merely an imaginary sort of creative thing which comes into the atmosphere, sometimes very powerfully, and it can be seen. I've learned a lot about this because Marshall's been a great help to me, and I found too that with figures, people that is, in fiction, I mean, for instance, you take a book that's been written and been read by millions of people, and the author has put a great deal into the conjuration, you might say, of the characters, and created very real, living sort of characters, you might say, so much so that people almost feel that they are real and that they do exist by the very thought process of people concentrating their thought on the happenings of the individuals concerned. They can temporarily create, in a kind of hallucination, a world, it's a sort of an environment very near Earth. It's something where these people can become temporarily images without any real fundamental substance. I mean, they're not people, they're not souls.
No, I know.
But
that.
You know what I mean? It's
you
totally
know
interesting.
Catholic.
Oh, I know of. I mean, I've never read the man. I should.
Well, he came through on there and explained that to me.
Oh, well, I'm going over old ground. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right. I like to hear things.
I don't want to tell you things that you already know, because
that's
why I'm awake.
I like to hear it again.
But it's tremendously intriguing. But what is intriguing to me is this swan, because I've seen it so distinctly in the room. It's gone now. No, it's gone now, possibly because we've talked about it, and it's lost its power. But it was something very strong. And I think that is true where people have a very, very strong interest in a certain something or other. They can, you see, I think that's what happens with artists, creative people.
Yes.
I think that is the beauty of it, you see. A creative artist can bring something into his work which is so powerful that it has a sort of dimension beyond material things, and it has a living force behind it. It isn't there, it never can become, of course, really, you might say, a soul as such, but it has a force or a power which is very, very strong, and many people can feel it, even generations after the time of the individual's death that created it. Any great work of art, it still has tremendous power to move people, to affect people, whether it's great music or great paintings, or whatever it is in the form of an artistic endeavor that has really had so much of the originator put into it. It lives on, it doesn't lose anything. In fact, if anything, it gains with time. It's strengthened by the love and the affection and the interest that's showered upon it by countless millions of people. And, of course, something like that does live over here. It's not a life in the sense of a human being, but it's a very vital something which has been put even more lifelike by the thought force and the love of countless people that have given it such admiration and so much sort of affection.
Yes, but it's only temporary, isn't it? It doesn't keep on living.
Well, no, not in that sense, no, but I'm thinking more, in a sense, regarding music, which, of course, people do so much. I mean, great music, for instance, still continues over here.
Yes.
Great symphonies are still played, but they're played in a more perfect state, in a more perfect way, and of course the sound is much more tremendous, and there's so much more harmony. I can't explain this, but it also applies to great artists who created great pictures. Those pictures still adorn places here, great buildings which are used constantly by people for various reasons, great halls and places of learning and teaching, great libraries where great books are contained, great places where people meet to sing and where great music is played. You see, all this still continues. Everything that has been created in beauty, everything that has been created by man with the power from within himself that is worthwhile, still exists. It's only the worser aspects of humanity, the worser aspects of man, that gradually lose their power. Is the physical, the material, all that sort of is soon lost. It's only the beauty that remains and the worthwhile. It's very difficult to explain this in a sort of language because you can't really, you know.
No, I know.
The culture of generations of nationals, the nationalities, the culture is never really lost. I mean, whether it's ancient Egyptian art or whether it's ancient Abyssinian or whether it is more recent, if that art has been truly created with the mind open to beauty and to the things of the spirit, in other words, if it is something which has the vitality of life, I'm talking here of spiritual life behind it, if it is good, if it is worthwhile, if it is truly beautiful, if it is truly creative in the highest sense, it still exists, it's not lost. I mean, I've been to places where people live, in some senses, you might say, very much as they would have done on Earth, but in a higher sense. In other words, you do get peoples who gather together and form communities, who live and have a sort of life which in some senses isn't unlike the life they led on Earth without all the defects. For instance, you have people who have progressed tremendously here, but who still prefer and still do wear the same sort of apparel that they would have worn perhaps 2,000 years ago. But if you could see the clothes they wear, they are not only very colourful, but the materials that they wear, and they're very real materials, they're not something that's just been conjured up out of the imagination, although there is thought behind it, of course, but these substances that are used are natural substances that are drawn from the life itself here, and they are formed and made and designed and created, and everything. You see, people have this vague sort of idea about our world, and it's sort of perhaps rather wishy-washy, and it's rather sort of religious and so on. It is nothing of the kind. It's a very real world, and when you really progress and you really do begin to understand more fully what it's all about and how to live the life and how to sort of become really part of it, you realize that everything here is creative, and everything that is creative is brought into being by effort. It's not suddenly put into your lap. You don't suddenly have something because you think you want it.
No, you say done by effort.
Well, for instance, there are people who create beautiful materials from various substances of material. I can't say, for instance, because this wouldn't be true. I mean, for instance, we don't have materials that are made from wool or taken from sheep or lambs, that sort of thing. Naturally, the animal kingdom is something which serves humanity, but it serves humanity in a different sense, a different way to what it did on Earth. We never kill, because there's no need to kill. In any case, you cannot kill here. Animals have their freedom and they have their form of life, and there's a great peace and tranquility among the animal kingdom, and the animal kingdom moves freely with the human kingdom, although there is, in a sense, a separation, but it's only a separation of experience, a separation of knowledge, separation inasmuch as the human race is more advanced. But nevertheless, there are substances which are drawn. I can't describe this exactly, but there are substances that are drawn from the natural surroundings, from nature itself, which can be utilized and can be created into various things, such as material for houses, and also things can be drawn from the ground, which is as solid and real to us as your world is to you. substances which are as real and as natural to us as your world substances are. And these are building materials, or materials that can be used for building, and architects design the buildings, and artisans create them. In other words, people who love to use their hands in a creative sense can use these different substances to create either buildings or clothes. You see, people seem to have this idea that you think of a beautiful building, and there it is. It isn't so. It may be so in a sense on certain spheres near the earth that their thought force is such that certain things are necessary to them, and they are in a state of illusion. But that's a very temporary sort of thing. But in the reality of life here, when you've made some progress, you realize that you don't just sit around or walk around just idly doing nothing. That you work in the community and with the community, but you do things that appeal to you, things that are reality in itself and creative. For instance, a person who wants to compose great music still composes great music. A great artist who wants to paint has materials to paint great pictures and murals. Indeed, many great artists work on the murals of great buildings here, and they use materials which, in some senses, are not unlike the materials of Earth. But you see, it's difficult to explain this, but the point is that there is a solidity and a reality about this. Nothing is just there for the wishing of it. You have to make the effort. People who love to sew and to do things with their hands, whether it is something quite simple for that matter, nevertheless they can do those things. And there are materials which in some ways, I don't say they are exactly the same, but they're not, and they don't all come from the same sources, or the sources that one would have expected or one knew they came from, but on earth. The substances, in some senses, are very similar to the sort of substances that you had on earth to work with, but no form of life suffers. Whereas in your world, to create something, quite often, to make something creative, some, possibly in the animal kingdom particularly, an animal must suffer,
yes,
or be used for the benefit of man. Here, it's quite a different thing. It's as if nature itself creates things of its own accord that can be used and willingly gives of itself to mankind. I don't know how I can explain
it. By nature, do you mean trees?
Yes, but you see, when we talk of nature,
yes.
I mean, you assume naturally and rightly, and that's all you can judge things by or sort of experience things by. You think of nature and the form of nature and the way of trees and forests and the ground, the earth, and all sorts of things that you grow in it, and the animal kingdom and so on. So the point is that when we talk about nature, I use this term only to try and explain something, even
yes,
that is very poor. But in nature, if I can use the term again, all sorts of other things are provided. In other words, nature is all the time recreating and giving forth and bringing into being certain things and substances and certain forms of, I was going to use the term life, which in a kind of sense it is, but all this life, all this substance, or whatever it is that you like to think of it or call it, I can't give it exactly name or shape, but nevertheless, it is all part of a natural existence in which we find ourselves, which is giving of itself to humanity to be used. In other words, it's not something that you're taking, it's something that is being presented to you, it's being given to you, it's being formed for you, that you might take it and use it for the beauty of life and for the betterment of life. In other words, everything that is done here works. I don't know if I'm putting this right, but works to a kind of a pattern. It's as if everything has its place for a reason. Nothing is put there without a reason. Nothing is presented without a purpose. You see, everything falls into a shape or into a pattern. You don't feel, for instance, if you want to do something here, that to do that something you've got to take from some other source, which may be detrimental to that source. It is that other source, if you can put it like that, is offering it to you with love and with all the desire that you shall use it. In other words, it's contributing. As we contribute one to the other in our sort of evolution and our awareness and consciousness of progress and desire for it, so all other things which are not human, that is from the point of view of human life or personality is also presenting itself. You see, if you can picture some world, a world, our world, in which everything is contributing toward the common good, and no one is taken from the other to the detriment of the other, whether it is individually or whether it is in a sort of sense of nature. You see, whereas man abuses nature, over here nature contributes to man, but it is not abused by man. It is something, it's almost difficult to explain, because we are in a sense part of nature, and nature is part of us. And if man could realize that on earth to a greater extent, that nature is contributing willingly. But the point is that man does not always realize what he should take from nature and what he should not take. Man has learned to kill, man has learned to use nature, often in a way in which it was never intended, and in consequence he destroys quite often things which by their very nature would have given, and which do, in some senses, do give. It's very difficult to put this in the way I want to put it, but here everything is, I was going to use the word perfect, perhaps that's not the correct word to use, but as far as it's possible to achieve or to know of a form of perfection, this is it. It is a world in which everything contributes willingly towards the other for the common good and for the happiness of all concerned. And every aspect of life here is a natural source and a natural sequence of events. I don't know how I can explain it.
All right, you're explaining very well.
I mean, don't think, you see, that we are not, I'm sure you don't think this, but we are real people. We are solid in our structure. I don't suggest that we have a physical frame identically the same as on Earth. For instance, although one may see oneself or see others, if you like, and we look identically, if you like, the same as we did on Earth in our prime, that is, we have shape and form, we have hands and fingernails and so on, then it's true, to all outward appearances, we are. But I've come to a conclusion that we are not identically the same in the fundamental sense. It's as if somehow we have achieved, before I keep getting onto this business of perfection, which I find irritating because there's no such thing possible, I don't know, but it appears anyway that we achieve a form of perfection. It's as if we lose the worst aspects of ourselves, whether it is mental or and physical, or both for that matter, and we retain all that is good, all that is necessary. But, for instance, not that one would be able to cut one's finger, but, you see, the point is this, that our fingers, to all outward appearances, are the same as they were on Earth. But I don't think that we have blood, I don't think that we have bones, not in the same sense that you understand the meaning of the term. It's as if we have a body which to all outward appearances is identical, but it isn't obviously the same. It isn't flesh and blood. It isn't organically the same, but in a sort of visual sense it's the same. And that's why we recognize, of course, each other. But also, another thing I've discovered too, but it's... For instance, you get somebody who looks in the mirror and says, oh my God, I wish to God I didn't look like this, you know, I wish I was different in appearance, I'd like to have been taller, I'd like to have been slimmer, and so on and so on. Mm. Well, don't think that because you have a physical body on earth that causes you some concern and you are dissatisfied with it, that figure will necessarily be the same here. You see, that is purely physical. In other words, if you have, figuratively speaking, an appearance which you do not like and which causes you grave concern, that will not necessarily be the same here. In other words, you can and you do change. But what I think is vitally important, of course this I suppose is perhaps the most important aspect of it, that we soon learn to realize that we are individuals that have inhabited possibly innumerable bodies at different times, physical bodies, and that whereas in one incarnation on earth we may have been, well, not particularly attractive physically, in another one we may have been most attractive physically, then we revert, if you like, to some extent, to what we would like to be. In other words, we lose certain aspects of our material self. And of course this is the whole point, in a sense, or one of the main issues of evolution, that you lose the sense of physical, material conception. You don't think of yourself in that physical way. You don't think so much as to the fact that you were not happy with your appearance in one particular incarnation, or you're happy with another. The point is that here, as you begin to assimilate life and understand life and become truly part of life, you begin to realize that the physical, material aspects are not really important at all. What was important to you when on earth, and your dissatisfactions, for instance, with your physical appearance, don't matter over here, because we don't see in that way. We see each other as we are, as spiritual beings, as individuals who have changed and lost the worser self, the physical self, and we don't concern ourselves. So, in a sense, we are reflections, that is, physically, that is, I don't mean physically, but outwardly, we appear as we are, not as bodies in the shape or form as we used to think or wanted to think of ourselves. In other words, we are recognizable. We do have shape and form as necessary. For instance, if someone wanted to recognize me, I presume they would recognize me, but at the same time, though they would recognize me, they would know that it was me with a greater difference, and something, when they think about someone they love that's gone over, they think of that person as they remember them, as they have photographs of them and so on, and that's all they can think of. It's an extraordinary thing how it isn't that people forget the personality, but over a number of years on earth, when you try to think of someone that's been very near and dear to you, I'm not saying that you can't recapture the appearance of the person, I suppose most people can, but it is extraordinary even so how many people have to go and look up a photograph to be quite sure what a person looked like if they've been dead 30 years, shall we say. And when it comes to thinking of them, they think of little incidents and things that stand out, yes, but so much has been lost in the process, so much that possibly would have mattered in a sense is forgotten, and when it comes to that voice, they find it terribly difficult to remember what their voice sounded like. In other words, you see, when a person's on earth, then naturally, that is the part of the person or the aspect of the person that strikes you most forcibly. In any case, you can live with a person on earth for 50 years and still not really know that person. You know certain aspects of that person's nature and character, but you don't really fundamentally get down to the rock bottom of that person. In other words, nobody really knows anybody on earth. The whole point is that you know certain aspects of their nature and their character, you know them from a physical point of view and so on, but so much can never be conveyed, so much can never be given when on earth, what your real personality is like, what you truly are like deep down inside. Well, of course, you see, people think very much when on earth, naturally of course, on physical grounds, and of course people like to think when that they come over here, that they will meet again, and they'll see the person they love, and that person will be identically the same. Well, in a sense, of course, this is not really so. It, of course, you'll recognize the person, and of course, for the temporary moment, if you like, if I can use time, that person will look the same, for your benefit. In other words, the person will know that you want them to be the same, and to look the same, so that they can be fully understood and recognized. But it soon begins to dawn on the newcomer that there are differences and that the person in some senses has changed. But of course what really happens is that over here, where the more subtle and sensitive conditions under which we exist, we are able to portray, if you like, or able to give out much more of our real self than ever we could on earth. And the people concerned are able to show themselves much more clearly as individuals and what they really are from the depth of their soul. In other words, over here it is soul sensing and soul recognizing much more than it is facial and material recognizing as you do on earth. In other words, it's not until you really get here and really become acclimatized to your new way of life and you begin to react in a normal manner as one does after time, being here, to other people, that you begin to become truly aware of what people are like. On Earth, there's all sorts of camouflage and facade, and you may love a person very much, and you may feel you know that person awfully well, and in a sense you do, up to a point. But nobody really senses and feels the intensity and a real full realization of what that person is, because a person is more than they see, more than they can express, more than they can be known. There are too many limitations, that's what it really amounts to on Earth, for anyone to really know anyone. You can know certain things, you can sense certain things, you can feel certain things, but it's not until people begin to sense and to know from within the inner consciousness and the inner soul awareness that you begin to become truly in tune with a person or part of a person. You see, all the destructive elements, all the things that cause concern and cause sadness and heartache and all the things that distress and all the things that irritate and all the things that annoy and all the things that make barriers between human beings, such as on Earth, gradually disappear over here, and you begin to live together in a peaceful harmony of the tranquility and the knowledge and experience of each other. In other words, you become, in a sense, though remaining individuals, you become part of each other. Truly, in a sense, you are wedded, in a sense. It's as if somehow one loses so much that kept people apart when on Earth. You lose all the worser aspects of self, and you begin to tune in and vibrate harmoniously, not only with individuals and people that you know and love, but with all life and all nature, if I can use this term again, all subscribes. It's something that one can't explain, because they really, quite honestly, no one can ever explain to people in your world certain aspects of life here, because they're beyond description. There's no way in which one can describe it. But if you can understand that all life, whatever form or shape it takes, whatever way it demonstrates itself or gives itself or has its being, all here, I'm talking about the spheres which I now am conscious of, everything is in perfect unison. It's as if everything is beating with the same heart, with the same tune, and the same sort of vibration which in itself, as far as one can use this term, I know it's not correct to use it, perfection. But you see, there are many, many different forms and states of being. And it's true that there are conditions or states of being near the Earth where things are very much out of tune, where the vibrations are very much, well, out of harmony. But I feel, well, in fact I don't feel, I know that since I've been coming back here over the last 2 years, I have progressed. I don't say that in a bumptious sense, but I have. I've got out of the jangling and the disharmony of my early months and weeks of coming over. I'm no longer sort of affected by it. Neither am I drawn back by things of Earth. I've got past that stage. I sort of feel that when I come back now, I'm tuning in, it's true, to you, to this condition here, but I'm not so conscious of the outside world, which must still affect you, because you're still on it. It doesn't affect me anymore. I wouldn't suggest by that I've lost interest in the world if I can be of any service to it. But at the same time, it doesn't have that same feeling or effect upon me. I feel now that I've really found myself. I say that's a way to express it.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
And you've been a great help to me. I don't think you'll ever know how much. I don't think anyone can explain this, but I was brought here and I was very much at sea in more senses than one. I mean, I was really sort of in a highly distressed emotional state. I was very disturbed about so many things and people, and I really couldn't settle and find myself. And at first, I think I was a bit of a bind. I must have been to Marshall and a few of the others, but they were so loving and so patient, so calm, placid with me, and all the time I was seething, you know, I was getting edgy and irritable, and goodness knows what wasn't happening to me, but everybody else seemed so calm, and I think, my God, you know, I don't know how they can be like this, but they were, in spite of seeing as I could see, even more deeply than I could hope to see at that time, see the state of the world and the affairs of the world, see into the innermost hearts of people that they knew and loved even, and see the seething turmoil of life generally, then the disillusionments and disappointments that they obviously must have had and faced up to, and at the same time remain calm and full of love. You know, I think it is that I've learned so much about love. It's funny to say this in a sense, because in a way I thought, well, I don't want to give the wrong impression again, but there are many forms and kinds of love, I know, but somehow I never knew what love was.